The summer movie season began with The Avengers, Age of Ultron. But Jurassic World appears to have stolen Thor's thunder. The fourth film in the Jurassic Park series has become the top movie of the year, grossing $1 billion worldwide in just 13 days. In this edition of Midday on Film, we talk about the summer blockbusters. Film critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed also review the latest Pixar creation, Inside Out, a documentary about the late Amy Winehouse, and Dope, which Chris Reed describes as American Graffiti meets Risky Business meets Boys in the Hood meets Friday. We'll also hear what Chris and Linda think of the latest in the Terminator series. Midday on Film, the summer blockbuster edition, after the news from NPR. Our film critics, Linda DeLibero from Johns Hopkins and Christopher Llewellyn Reed from Stevenson University. Chris also blogs at chrisreedfilm.com. And he has a cable TV gig on Howard County Cable called Real Talk. That's R-E-E-L, as in real, you know, film real. Chris, nice to see you.
Great to be here, Dan, as always.
Linda, nice to see you again.
Great to see you,
You look great.
Dan.
You got new glasses. You look really nice.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, a little compliment. It's summertime. And, you know, this week, Chris got to introduce Jaws on the big screen at the Senator because it's the 40th anniversary of Steven Spielberg's film. And there was a big crowd there, sellout practically, right?
It was fantastic. There were so many people there to see a 40-year-old film. Of course, the film that helped launch the modern blockbuster era.
Well, that's why I brought it up.
A great time was had by all.
That's why I brought up the Jaws thing, because we're talking summer blockbusters, and we've got a couple of them here, don't we?
We do.
Why, we certainly do.
Jurassic World, I read the word billion associated with box office for Jurassic World, and I said, wait a minute, billion? James Cameron didn't direct this, right? So this is actually a non-James Cameron film that broke a billion.
And in fact, it's not only a non-James Cameron film, it's only the second feature by its director. The guy's name is Colin Trevorrow, and the first film he did was called Safety Not Guaranteed, which was a relatively small indie film. So they gave him a chance, right? Spielberg, who's an executive producer on this franchise, on this film, kind of, you know, sees him perhaps a little bit like him. But when he made Jaws, he was, you know, had made a few small films, only one theatrically released one.
Which
Duel.
Was what?
Sugarland Express.
Sugarland Express with Goldie Hawn.
That is correct. So, you know, Colin Trevorrow has made this, you know, film that's now a huge box office juggernaut, just like Jaws was in its day. And so, although I don't think Jurassic World approaches artistically any of the heights that Jaws did, it's certainly killing it at the box office.
Grossing $1 billion worldwide in just 13 days. This was released in June, right?
It was. It's very impressive.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we want to talk about that one first?
Absolutely.
Okay. And I would like to invite our listeners to call in and join us here for Midday on Film today, because we're talking about the summer movies. If there's one you saw and you really liked it, or one you didn't, or one you're looking forward to, you have a question for Chris and Linda, please give us a ring anytime this hour, 410-662-8780. And if you went to see Jaws at the Senator, I wanted to get there, but we had some news that day that broke down at City Hall, so I couldn't get out to the theater.
Minor incidents at City Hall.
Yeah, but I did want to see it on the big screen. You can see it again this Sunday morning at 10 a.m. at the Senator.
That is correct.
All right. So let's talk about Jurassic World first. Why don't you give us a clip from it first, Chris?
Absolutely. So here's the deal with the film. 20 years after the first theme park went bust, after its creatures, if you remember, escaped and made a dinner out of their handlers, a new park is opened on the same island. It's been opened by a businessman, the world's seventh richest man, Simon Masrani. He's played by Irfan Khan, who played the older Pi in Life of Pi. And, you know, they're worried about their numbers, their attendance numbers dropping, so they're looking for bigger, badder, better in terms of dinosaurs, and are designing something which they end up branding Indominus Rex, which is a T-Rex mixed with all sorts of other DNA that nobody but the designer knows.
Genetic engineering.
Genetic
here.
Engineering of the dinosaur to make them more dangerous.
Very dangerous.
And what happens is, of course, what you expect to happen, which is something goes wrong. The dinosaurs get loose, as they have in every other one of these films from Jurassic Park onwards. And, you know, some some intrepid humans have to, led by Chris Pratt, who had such a great year last year with Guardians of the Galaxy and the Lego Movie, have to save the day. And in this clip, Chris Pratt, who is a Velociraptor trainer, steps in to rescue a hapless fellow who's fallen into the raptor pit. And even though he's their handler, no one's really sure if once he's on the ground with them, if they're going to respect his status as an alpha. So let's listen.
No, hold your fire! Hold your fire! Do not fire! Put 12 amps in these animals. They're never going to trust me again. Lou, stand down. Stand down. Hey, what did I just say? Delta, I see you. Back up. Okay. Good.
This is very interesting. Chris, you get so excited about these movies. Now, that was a very excited introduction, passionate, I would even say, for this clip.
I love big-budget Hollywood entertainment when it works. Unfortunately for me, this film didn't really work. The title of my review was 3D Dinosaurs Eat 2D Humans, and that's a good thing, just because I found I found the humans completely uninteresting. But, yeah, Linda has...
It's not as if you don't like any of these big-budget action films, right? You do. I know you do.
I like them when they're good.
Right.
I don't like them when they're terminally stupid.
Oh, jeez. You can't be wowed by the special effects and the CG.
Not when I've seen them a million times before and better. And, it was very disappointing. I really felt for the Velociraptors.
Oh, I agree.
They were the only characters in the film who I had any response to at all, and I wish they would have eaten all of the actors, including Chris Pratt, because Chris Pratt, who is so lovely, so funny in Guardians of the Galaxy, is just a lump of meat here. And everyone was wasted. The politics of this film are so retrograde. I guess that's maybe what's appealing to people. It's all about the nuclear family and really how deeply important it is to have a husband and a wife and children, and divorce is bad. I mean, yeah, it's crazy. It's 2015, last time I looked. In all ways, it was, and the first hour of the film is such a bore. Mm. I could barely sit through it. It was so boring. It was so stupid, and it really depresses me.
Office? What explains that then? People must be going to see the film more than one time, I would even say, if the box office.
They are. And this goes back to what we were talking about in May, right? The sort of the self-reinforcing cycle of what studios are producing for theatrical release. This is big spectacle. And, I think I like the film a little more than Linda, though I agree with all of her criticisms. But I thought the action sequences, particularly once we get past the first hour, are actually frequently exciting. And so if that's what you want in a summer film, this is the film that you'll probably gravitate towards seeing. But I completely agree with the sexual politics line. I think that what we see on the screen comes out of... the school of how I learned to stop worrying and embrace misogyny. Bryce Dallas Howard plays this ice princess, professional woman who has to be brought down a peg. And I've seen other articles out there in print and on the web about this, but it hasn't stopped people from going to see the film.
Yes, her high heels have generated an entire Twitter feed, I think.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, teetering on her little platform.
Let's go to a Pixar production.
Oh, yes. And this is interesting. We're going to talk about Inside Out now. And this film has been duking it out with Jurassic World at the box office. It's finally pulled ahead now in the daily box office tallies. It squeaked ahead last weekend, but it's been out one week less than Jurassic World, which opened the weekend before Inside Out came out. But Jurassic World has been killing it. Inside Out has been significantly behind, but it's doing really good business for an original film that doesn't belong to any franchise. And it's co-directed by Pete Docter, who directed what had previously been one of my favorite Pixar films. I like most Pixar films. Up. which has the most devastating opening 10 minutes of any film I've seen in a long time. So Inside Out is about the voices inside our heads.
Emotions.
Right? About emotions.
Voices
inside a tween's head. There are five emotions, apparently based in kind of contemporary modern understandings of psychology. We've got joy, sadness, anger, disgust, and envy are the five emotions in that. Right? I didn't get that wrong. Those are the five?
I believe so. They were going to throw in a few more, but they had
they kept it to five. And the lead emotion for this particular tween girl is joy. And what's interesting, we go inside a few other characters' heads at some point, and it's fascinating to see sort of which lead emotion we see in other people's head. Like we go inside someone and sadness is in charge. But here joy is in charge, voiced by Amy Poehler. And Amy Poehler is who we're going to hear in this clip describing how core memories are formed inside of this particular little girl.
Anyway, these are Riley's memories, and they're mostly happy, you'll notice, not to brag. But the really important ones are over here. I don't want to get too technical, but these are called core memories. Each one came from a super important time in Riley's life. Like when she first scored a goal. Oh, that was so amazing. And each core memory powers a different aspect of Riley's personality. Like Hockey Island. Goofball Island is my personal favorite.
Come back here, you little monkey!
Yep, Goofball is the best.
This sounds like an educational film for kids. What?
Well, it's a wonderful adventure story because what happens is joy and sadness, sort of who are battling out for control of Riley's emotions, end up being ejected from the control center of the brain. And then it turns into a quest film as they fight their way back.
It sounds like exposition.
Well, you have to.
It is. That is a particular moment in the film where you're.
But
you're,
it isn't all like that.
But
is
you've
it?
Got to understand, while they're talking, all this amazing visual stuff is also happening.
Yes, and we are on radio, so yeah, that's why I wanted to get back quickly and talk about this. Yeah. So it's not. The narrative is not like that throughout, right?
That is correct, because it is a quest film, as joy and sadness have to fight their way back to the control center, learn some important lessons about themselves, and sort of figure out how to guide Riley through the difficult tween years heading up to her teenager years.
Yeah, it's what Pixar does best. It reeks. It sort of wrings tears from adults who regret the loss of childhood. That is what Pixar does to perfection. And this
were you a
film,
victim of that?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
for me, the end of Toy Story 3, is the
please
saddest.
Please don't bring that up.
See?
Please don't bring that
I'm
up.
I'm telling you, that's the moment that is same. The epitome of what Pixar does. And certainly this film is no exception. It's very smart. It's funny. It's witty. I think there's a moment in the middle of the film that sags a little bit. There's a little bit too much exploration of the brain. It kind of meanders a little bit. But by and large, to putting it up against Jurassic in terms of box office, it's like putting the stunningly intelligent against the stunningly stupid.
Okay.
And I, for one, am very happy that it's winning the race.
Let's hear from Lorenzo. He called in to say something about the former Jurassic World, which is doing, blockbusters at the box office. Go ahead, Lorenzo. What did you want to say about that film?
First of all, I agree with Linda. The movie, it was just horrible. The plot, the family value theme, I don't even know where they got all that stuff from. I'm with her. The animals should eat all the human beings. I agree. But the best thing about the movie is I saw it in the Philippines 2 weeks ago. My wife's a Filipina, and we visited her family there. And so we actually saw it in the Filipino movie theater. It was great from that aspect because, just watching someone in another country enjoy an American film, it was fantastic. Huh. The best thing about it was this. First of all, when you travel to the Philippines, if a family member lives in America, when they travel to the Philippines, wherever you go, you take every family member with you, and of course the American pays, of course. But here's the deal: I had to take 10 family members with us to the movie theater. It cost me, I think, somewhere around 2,000 pesos. That's about $44 for a family of 10.
So
it was awesome.
That's funny. That sounds like a great experience, Lorenzo.
It was. But I mean, I tell you, the entire family enjoyed it, and it really seemed like the Filipinos enjoyed it, and I think that was the joy that I got out of the movie, just being in another country and seeing it. That's all.
I have one question for you. Do they sell popcorn in the Filipino movie theater?
They do. I'm going to tell you. I want to take up too much of your time, but what was really amazing to me is when we got to the movie theater, it was pretty much sold out. It was 10 of us, but we couldn't sit next to each other. But they actually plugged in a computer and found 10 seats in the movie theater for us. Okay, so they're very, very
accommodating.
Accommodating, and not only that, you have an usher that takes you to your seat.
Aww.
Wow. That's great. That's like the old days. That is the old days. But Chris?
It was awesome. In a very modern movie theater, it was awesome. It was really awesome.
Thank you, Lorenzo.
Yeah, as a kid growing up, spending a lot of time in France, I'm half French, the French theaters, at least in Paris, often have an usher who would take you to your seat, which is always interesting.
It's pretty classy. Yeah. A tweet from Josh on Inside Out. He says, as an expecting couple, we loved Inside Out, such a fun story based in science.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best films of the summer.
All right, Chris, yeah. I got that. Thank you very much. I wanted to ask you this. When you go to a movie, do the names of actors and actresses appear on the screen before you see the film or in the credits at the end of the film?
Yes.
Generally.
I answer yes because it depends on the film.
Oh. Okay, so my son went to see Inside Out. He liked the movie very much. But he said for the first hour or so, it was killing him that he couldn't figure out who was doing the voices. He said, is that Amy Poehler? I'm not sure. And he got distracted because he wanted to get an answer to this. Right. And I said, you could have Googled it while you were sitting there.
He might be ejected for being on the cell phone.
Right.
I know that feeling.
You know that feeling?
That drives me nuts, too. And it's done that so many times that now I know to go online beforehand and get all the voices connected up with the characters.
Okay.
I hadn't done that, and the voice that was getting to me was Sadness, and it's Phyllis from The Office.
Phyllis, I remember
her. And it was killing me who it was, and then after about a half hour, I'm like, got it.
Excellent. Chris Reed and Linda DeLibro, it's Midday on Film. We're taking a look at the summer movies. You can join us if you have a story like Lorenzo's or if you just want to talk about one of the films. 410-662-8780. We'll talk about a documentary about Amy Winehouse when we get back, a film called Dope and Minions, which is actually competing quite well at the box office with Jurassic World. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Summer movies with Chris and Linda. So what's the deal on Minions? What is this? This is not Pixar. This is Universal.
It's, Illumination Studios and Universal is distributing it.
Okay. I read something about that it was already doing quite well. Maybe I'm wrong, but did it open overseas
already? I know that it opened yesterday in the States to $6.2 million. You just gave me that figure. And that's
Thursday.
That's a really impressive Thursday take. I mean, it's got a built-in audience. It's a prequel to Despicable Me and Despicable Me 2. It's nowhere near the quality of the animated film we were just discussing, Inside Out. But as I said, it does have that built-in audience, and it is a great film for families with little kids. Mm-hmm. Although, ultimately, I thought it was just kind of fun, and I chuckled a little bit and laughed out loud maybe once. It's perfectly harmless. It's cute. And if you're looking for a film other than Inside Out to which to bring little kids, it's a perfect film for them.
Did you mention Despicable Me?
That is right. It's the prequel. Because in Despicable Me and Despicable Me 2, the villain, Gru, has these helpers, his minions, who are these yellow, one-eyed or two-eyed creatures who wear goggles and speak in an Esperanto-like gibberish language.
Yeah.
And we don't know where they come from. Well, this is the film that tells us where they came from. And it turns out that they predate humans. They evolved sometime before or during the Jurassic era. And they've always needed to serve some evil overlord. And we learn in this opening, narrated by Jeffrey Rush, that they have an unfortunate propensity to cause, unintentionally, of course, the demise of their masters. And so this is a film that takes us really quickly through their history and then lands us in 1968. We end up in swinging London, where Sandra Bullock voices the supervillain of that time, Scarlet Overkill. and she's married to, I forget his first name, but Mr. Overkill, who's voiced by John Hamm, who is actually one of the funniest voices in the film. And she ends up hiring the minions to be her new assistants. And in this clip that we have, she's explaining to them. And by the way, the minions are all voiced by the co-director of the film, Pierre Coffin. Every single voice we hear, the minions, is the co-director of the movie. And she's explaining to them what she needs them to do.
It is time to get down to business. Do you know who this is?
La Cucaracha?
This is Queen Elizabeth, ruler of England. Oh, I love England. The music, the fashion. I'm seriously thinking about overthrowing it someday. Anyway, this pale drink of water oversees it all. I'm her biggest fan, love her work, and I really, really, really want her crown. Steal me the crown and all your dreams come true. Respect. Power.
Banana.
Banana.
You know, that's, this is good. It's not as good as the
inside. It's mildly funny.
Okay. This story from Bloomberg says that they've spent $593 million on publicity for Minions.
My God.
Is that amazing?
Doesn't surprise me.
So they're expecting quite a lot of profit.
They know they're going to get profit. And I was just saying during the break that this is a film that demonstrates with every word of the mishmash of Esperanto that it was designed for an international audience, and that's where it's going to make its bucks. And, of course, it'll make a lot of money here, too. But it's a kind of film that every, you know, it doesn't matter if you don't speak the language, which is the case with so many blockbusters, and which is why they're so indistinguishable from each other and mostly so. I was, maybe it's advantageous, but I hadn't seen Despicable Me. And so I came into this really fresh, not knowing that much about the Minions. And, you know, it's pleasant. It's got a lot of in jokes about the swinging 60s for the adults or the baby boomers that'll sail right over every kid's head, which is amusing. But, you know, there's something missing at the heart of it. There's nothing really exciting to propel this film, including Sandra Bullock's voice, which I find to be truly underwhelming for a super villainous. And I think that is one of the problems, one among many. But, you know, it doesn't matter, because if they spent $593 million on publicity for this film, you can guarantee that they're expecting to get it back, and they probably will.
By the way, the big sales, according to the same story this summer, Furious 7, which we didn't mention, then Jurassic World, Avengers, which was from
early May. I think it was May 1st. Yeah.
Right. Minions is in there. That's the European, has a European release. Fifty Shades of Grey, I'm amazed that it's still there. And Cinderella, Disney Cinderella.
It's been a great year for movies. It's been the best year ever, right?
You think so, Chris?
No, box office wise.
Box office wise. Yeah, we're not talking quality. We're talking returns.
I didn't mean that.
Yeah.
I said, what I meant to say was, does that jive with your information,
yeah,
Chris?
Yeah, absolutely.
What Linda just said?
Yes.
Okay. Now we're going to go to a very different kind of film. We're going to go to a documentary about Amy Winehouse. Talk about a very different kind of film. There isn't much of a segue here, folks. I'm sorry. We're going from Minions to a documentary about Amy Winehouse because Chris and Linda are eager to talk about this.
Yeah, so this is a film that opens today at the Charles, and it's been getting it's already had a limited release in both the UK and in select cities in the United States, and it's been getting a really good per-theater average. So this is a film that could do really well as a documentary, and of course, documentaries generally don't rake in the kind of bucks we've been talking about. It's directed by it's called Amy, and it's directed by Asif Kapadia. And Asif Kapadia did a documentary a few years ago about the Brazilian Formula One race car driver Ayrton Senna, another person who died young. And this is his profile. of Amy Winehouse, who died in 2011 of alcohol poisoning at just 27 years of age. She was, of course, the enormously talented jazz and pop singer, known for her album Frank, her debut album in 2003, and then the 5 Grammy winner Back to Black in 2008. She had well-documented problems with alcohol and drugs. I knew very little about her before seeing this film. I was horrified by what I saw on the screen. In fact, I'd go so far as to call this film the first documentary horror film that I've ever seen, because it's like we're watching somebody be destroyed by demons, except in this case, it's the, you know, it's fame and addiction are the demons that eventually bring her down. I found it incredibly powerful, particularly because we have all of this archival material. Her first manager, Nick Shemansky, whom we see in the film, gave hundreds of hours of footage to the director, as did some of her childhood friends. And so we see this young woman, you know, in unguarded moments, both on and off stage. And it's really devastating. I think, you know, it might be a little too long here and there, but I'm beginning to change my opinion since I first saw it. I'm beginning to think that everything that we see on the screen is there for a reason. And I think it's just a masterpiece of documentary filmmaking.
Linda.
No, it's not too long. And I think one of the reasons it has to be sustained at the pace it is, and that it has to be told carefully, is that the documentary is done in a way where there are no talking heads. We simply see footage of her, voiceovers of interviews, but we are watching her from a very young age. I think the first home movie is like 14, all the way to the end of her life, which is extraordinary. This is the contemporary age when every moment of our lives is documented. And as he did with Senna, he takes this kind of unique collage approach so that we see before our eyes the ruin of this woman. And it's absolutely devastating. And, you know, I was a fan of Amy Winehouse. I thought I knew a lot about her. And yet there were so many cliches because of the press relentlessly making her the punchline of so many jokes about her addictions, et cetera. Deeply cruel. And to see this happen to her and to understand where she began and where she ended up right before your eyes really is, as Chris says, it's a horror film.
The film savages the press and those members of her entourage and family who were, shall we say, less than helpful in assisting Amy in dealing with her addiction issues. You see the press just kind of go after her for her public intoxication. And of course, they don't have the advantage. They didn't have the advantage in 2010, 2011 of having seen the film that we've just seen to perhaps realize how cruel they're being. But I hope this gives everyone pause when they're criticizing public figures who perhaps are having meltdowns, just to think about the potential backstory. So we do have a clip, and it's exactly what Linda was saying, of seeing her at her youngest, at 14. This is home video footage. It opens the film. It's a birthday party. Where you're going to hear, you know, it's very informal. You hear some voices of young women. And then at the end of the clip, we'll hear Amy Winehouse singing Happy Birthday. And even at 14, she had some impressive pipes.
These are the only 3 people left. This is Mr. Alex Steele, Mrs. Juliet Ashby, Mrs. Amy Winehouse. In other words, Mrs. Amy Winehouse. And everyone else is gone. This was my 14th.
Do you want a lick of the lollipop? Come on, have a lick.
No, I
have
don't.
A lick.
No, no, no. No one wants. I'm trying to lick talk. It. No one wants to lick
no
your
one.
Slobbery
just
lollipop.
Lick it.
Here's me. It's my 14th birthday evening in party.
Happy birthday,
yes,
to
happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear. Happy birthday to you.
That's the 14-year-old Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really comes forward in this film is her, not just this voice that she had, but her extraordinary songwriting power. The first album, Frank, was not well known in this country, and I think now there will be a resurgence of interest in her, that earlier album, which is much more of a jazz album. But I think the saddest and most sustained comment on this in this film is on the way that the the press today become such a crucial element in the making of celebrity that everybody is destroyed by this. And yes, her father does not get off scot-free. He was very upset with this film. But boy, once you see it, you realize the people around her really just sucked her dry.
Did the dad try to quash the film?
Well, there's nothing they can do. I mean, once you sign a release, you're part of the film.
Okay.
I think they've just been coming out publicly to denounce the film.
Right, and to deny what they were saying in the movie, which is...
I can't think of what the song was called, but a friend of mine sent me a link to a video of Amy Winehouse singing with a guitar player, some jazz ballad, and I'm sorry I don't have the title right in front of me. I can't remember what it was. I wasn't prepared for this today, but I wasn't prepared for what I saw in this little video that was sent to me. I was, you know, spellbound by it. She was so arresting, a singer. Yeah. It was a ballad of some kind, and yeah, what a talent, what a waste.
What a talent, what a waste.
Glad you mentioned this film. So will we be able to see it here in Baltimore?
Yeah, it just opens today at the Charles.
At the Charles. Before we take our next break here on Midday on Film with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, let's take a call from Gene in Harford County on a film we've already talked about, Minions. And Gene, you're just back from France, is that right?
France and Spain, yes, with 20 high school students who were delighted about the fact that there were Minion billboards everywhere we went, and Minion toys and Minion everything in the stores. I was hoping they'd get a French and Spanish experience, and they were looking at the Minions. But as to Amy Winehouse, I'm also reading a book called Star Island about a young actress singer who is not very talented, and they're sort of plotting, well, even if she dies, it wouldn't be a big deal. But they said, well, we won't get the bump like Amy Winehouse. I mean, there's even a comment about her in this movie, like she's no Amy Winehouse, so even if she were to die, her CD sales wouldn't go up. So I just thought that was...
That's a book called Star Island?
Star Island, and the author is H-I-A-A-S-E-N. I had never read him before, Carl.
Oh, Carl Harrison, from Florida. Yep, yeah. Yeah, know his brother. Thank you very much, Gene, for that. That's interesting. We don't always think about how global these movies are. This is one of America's biggest exports. A short break on Midday on Film. We'll come back and talk some more with Chris and Linda. We're going to talk about Dope next, right? And also there's a biopic about Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys that we'll be discussing in the next segment of our show. If you'd like to share a comment about a summer movie, 410-662-8780.
Selfless.
Hey, we're back on the air with Chris and Linda, Christopher Llewellyn Reed from Stevenson University, along with Linda DeLibero from Johns Hopkins, who joins us once a month for Midday on Film, sometimes more than that. Because we just talked about the Amy Winehouse documentary, let's talk about the biopic about Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, Love and Mercy.
Yes, so this is only the second feature by a man who's otherwise known as a producer, Bill Pollat. He was one of the producers on 12 Years a Slave. And it tells a story of Brian Wilson in two different time periods, the 1960s and the 1980s. So in the 1960s, he is the main songwriter and creative force behind the Beach Boys. And in the 1980s, he is a man suffering from the aftermath of repeated mental breakdowns, excessive drug and alcohol use, and then even worse, the care of a sort of guru-like psychologist, experimental psychologist, Eugene Landy. And so we go back and forth, we ping pong between these two time periods. In the first one, he's played by Paul Dano. And in the 80s, he's played by John Cusack. And the film sort of, you know, based on the facts of his life, and it ends with Brian Wilson finally sort of emerging from this dark, dark period of his life in the 1980s. We have a clip that's sort of representative for me of much of what is so spectacular about the film, which is kind of the way it reveals to the audience the immense creative power of Brian Wilson and why he matters. We get so much of the studio recording sessions. He did this incredibly innovative album called Pet Sounds in the 1960s, which did terribly in terms of sales at the time, but is now regarded as one of the best albums ever made. And in this sequence, we're going to hear Paul Dano talking to the session musicians as they're preparing to record one of these new songs for that album.
Remember, it's the higher octave on the upbeats in the bridge.
Hey, Brian.
I love that.
Brian.
Yeah.
I think you might have screwed up here.
Really? Let me see.
Well, you've got Lyle playing in D, and the rest of us are in A major.
Yeah, that's right.
How does that work? Two bass lines and two different keys?
Well, it works in my head. I mean, it's all playing in my head, the orchestration and the five vocal parts. I think it's going to work. Let's try it.
Here's how I want you to do it. It goes, boom, two, three, four, ba-doom. So it's the first beat on the last bar of the intro. Boom, two, three, four, ba-doom.
Nice, nice. Linda, what did you think of this film?
These scenes of Brian Wilson creating Pet Sounds in the studio are breathtaking. Atticus Ross, who works usually with David Fincher on his films, got access from Brian Wilson of all of his master tapes, all of them, and used them to create the sound design of this film. So you have this merging of the album as we know it, the album as, you know, different outtakes presented, and what was in his head. He does this beautiful job of mixing the sound so that we understand that Brian hears this in his head. He hears these visions, and it's just so beautifully realized. And Paul Dano is spectacular in this film as Brian Wilson.
The younger the Wilson from the 60s.
Yes, yeah. And I understand why the director chose John Cusack to choose the older, troubled Brian, but I really regret that decision because Paul Dano is so great. And it really threw me out of the movie because he's not Brian Wilson. I find his performance very mannered and distracting. And I think I would have had much more of an emotional feeling for that older Brian and his plight if we would have had that continuity. It was a very bold experimental thing to do, and I admire it, but I just thought,
now, usually when there's a time lag like that, Hollywood just gives us an older version of the same actor playing that role, right?
Yes, and suggests that they're two different guys because of all these terrible things
that's
that happened
weird.
To him. Yeah, and I understand it was, I think it was an attempt to break the film out of the traditional biopic mold, which it does to a certain extent. But I also think if you've got an actor who is inhabiting this character so thoroughly as the young Brian Wilson, I think Paul Dano is a great enough actor to have been able to realize the older Brian Wilson.
Well, now
I
got to see this just for this reason.
I
just
want
to offer a counter opinion because although Linda and I both love this film, I completely disagree with the idea that, for me anyway, John Cusack didn't work. And one of the things I love about the movie is its experimental approach to the storytelling. Right in the first scene, it almost feels as if the projector is on the fritz. The sound drops out because, remember, this is a man who had auditory hallucinations and had, I think, 95% or 98% hearing loss in one ear. So the sound design is key to the film. And right in the very first scene of the film, some weird stuff is going on. And all throughout the film, the director is experimenting with the storytelling. And for me, this idea of having two different actors to sort of show visually how different and what, you know, how different Brian Wilson was in the 80s and what he had to overcome to work his way back. And there's a lot of quick cuts towards the end as he is fighting, where he's John Cusack, Paul Dano, child Brian Wilson. And for me, that technique worked. It may not work for everyone, but it worked for
me. Okay. Let's hear what Frank says. Frank's calling from Fells Point with an opinion about exactly what we're talking about here, the casting of this movie. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay, I've been kind of obsessed with Brian Wilson for about 45 years, so he's my favorite creative artist. He's like, to the recording studio, what Orson Welles was to cinema. He's one of the great innovators. My problem with the movie, and I agree with one of your people there, if since they kept intercutting back and forth and back and forth, I couldn't accept John Cusack as the older Brian Wilson. Paul Dano is the younger guy. He's phenomenal, and he shows you the enthusiasm of his genius at that time. I just couldn't accept the fact that he looked so different. John Cusack, the intercutting back and forth, I couldn't accept it.
Okay.
That's my comment.
Thank you, Frank. Yeah, I'm very curious now to see it for that. I want to see it for other reasons, too, because I'm fascinated by the Brian Wilson story. Remember the documentary about him?
Yes.
Called I Was Not Born for These Times or something like that.
I Just Wasn't Born for These Times.
That's it. Yeah. Wasn't that it?
Okay. It was the name of one of his songs.
Comment from Helen in Owings Mills on this movie. She says, we saw the Brian Wilson movie Love and Mercy and left feeling that it did a great job of showing his creative process, but we couldn't figure out why Melinda would fall in love with such a seriously damaged guy. I want to help him or be his friend, yeah, but marry the guy? Anyway, the movie didn't really explain it, and she remained opaque even though she was a main character.
She's referring to Melinda Ledbetter, who's the woman who eventually Brian married in the 1990s, and she's played by Elizabeth Banks in the film.
Thank you. Helen also says that Paul Giamatti chewed the scenery a bit too much.
Well, he does have that tendency. He works often with his eyebrows.
That's true.
He plays the experimental psychologist Eugene Landy.
Let's get quick comments on two movies from Ruth in Charles Village, who wants to say something about Jurassic World and also about Inside Out. Go right ahead, Ruth.
Oh, hi. So I saw Jurassic World and left laughing at it hysterically. The ending was not really being intended as comic, but, I don't know, T-Rex walking off into the sunset was just absolutely hysterically funny to me.
Okay. And what about Inside Out?
Yes, I think that the woman who played Sadness, Phyllis from The Office, I think she deserves an Oscar. I don't know if they have Oscars for voiceover parts, but I think she deserved an
Oscar.
She's
great.
Interesting.
She is great. I agree, but I don't think they give Oscars. Although there was talk back when Scarlett Johansson did the voice of the operating system in Her about whether they could give an Oscar for somebody who's just doing voiceover.
Chris Reed. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I hadn't even planned to see Inside Out. I wasn't even interested in it. And I was crying in it. It was really good.
Really? And Linda, you got a little verklempt too, huh?
Oh gosh, yeah.
Okay,
me too.
You
I was verklempt.
You really? Have a heart of stone in order not to, to feel that.
I guess I better see that too, because I need to go through that once in a while. Anyway, Chris describes the film Dope as American Graffiti meets Risky Business meets Boys in the Hood meets Friday. That's from your own review on Chris Reed.
Yes, it is.
So
this is a high school film set in the rough neighborhood, the Los Angeles neighborhood of Inglewood, where the director, son of Nigerian immigrants Rick Famuyiwa, himself grew up. And it's a really it's an amazingly fresh film because we get these three basically geeks in the hood, self-described geeks. High school seniors, very smart kids, one of whom is Tony Revolori from the Grand Budapest Hotel, who are trying to navigate their high school years as geeks in a neighborhood where you can actually get shot. And in fact, and we see this right up, even though the film is very funny, the director never lets us forget that there's real danger out there. And everything that they've tried to avoid, the drug dealers, the violence, ends up coming their way, of course, as they go through a series of misadventures where they have to prove their mettle, and in this case, primarily their intellectual mettle, which they have in great quantities. And it's a really fun, really intelligent, witty action comedy that I highly recommend.
Do we have a clip from
it? We do. So this kind of right in the start of the film establishes the ambitions of our main character, Malcolm, who's played by Shameik Moore, as he's talking to his college guidance counselor about the essay that he's writing for his Harvard application.
Malcolm, when I see stuff like this personal essay, I think you're not taking the process seriously.
I'm taking it seriously, Mr. Bailey, I promise. I'm talking about something that I love. I mean, it's well-reasoned, supported with historical data. It shows creativity, critical thinking. If Neil deGrasse Tyson was writing about Ice Cube, this is what it would look like.
I suggest you go in a different direction. Write something personal about you, your family, your life.
Yeah, I could write about the typical, I'm from a poor, crime-filled neighborhood. raised by a single mother, don't know my dad, blah, blah.
It's cliche.
Sure.
Did you like Dope, Linda?
Yes, I did. And to that mashup, I would also add House Party, because it's a very there's sweetness in this film, and there's dark, there's light. The whole overarching point of it seems to be that we tend to categorize, especially when we're talking about African Americans in the hood, and this complicates everything. And there are a lot of incredibly current issues that are addressed in this film. And about racial identity, about what life in the hood means, about stereotyping. And it's all done in a very clever, entertaining, and beautifully subtle way in many ways. And great soundtrack, 90s hip-hop. It's awesome.
Thank you, Linda. You and Chris also want to recommend Me and Earl and the Dying Girl?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Infinitely Polar Bear.
Yes, other than that slightly unfortunate title, because it seems to promise a very different kind of film, I'm a big fan of the movie. It's okay. Directed by Maya Forbes. It's a biographical film with Mark Ruffalo and Zoe Saldana. Highly recommend.
We learned today that Omar Sharif died. Chris brought in a clip for us.
Brought in a clip from his first English language film. He was an Egyptian actor who we know primarily from David Lean's films Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago. And here is a moment right after he shot Peter O'Toole's Arab friend Lawrence at his well, the well that Omar Sharif's character owns. And he's just shot and killed this man. And now he approaches Peter O'Toole and introduces himself.
I am Ali ibn al-Kharish.
I've heard of you.
So, what was Hazimi doing here?
He was taking me to help Prince Faisal.
You have been sent from Cairo?
Yes.
I have been in Cairo for my schooling. I can both read and write. My Lord Faisal already has an Englishman.
Yes.
What is your name?
My name is for my friend. None of my friends is a murderer.
You are angry, English. He was nothing. The well is everything. The Hazimi may not drink at our wells. He knew that. Salam. Hut, hut, hut.
That, of course, is a camel.
Camel
making
is camel.
All that noise.
Yeah.
It's not Lawrence.
It's not Lawrence. It's not Omar.
Omar Sharif, very handsome man.
Yes, very handsome man. And very, there's a tragedy, too, there. One of his more popular, famous roles in the 60s when he was really having his moment was in Funny Girl as Nicky Arnstein, the lover of Fanny Bryce, Barbara Streisand, who he was a notorious gambler. And, in fact, in real life, so was Omar. And he ended up losing a great deal of his money, and I think never really recovered from that. And kind of a sad life.
I thought he was just a bridge player, but he was a serious gambler.
He was a very serious gambler, and he really did lose. In fact, Peter O'Toole told some really wonderful stories about the gambling they did on the set of Lawrence of Arabia, and those are very interesting stories.
Anyway, I'm glad we got to pay some homage here to the actor Omar Sharif, dead at the age of 83. Chris and Linda, thank you for being here today. Again, I want to remind folks, Chris Reed blogs about all these films at chrisreedfilm.com, and he has a new episode of Real Talk coming up on Howard County TV, HCC TV. What did I want to ask you? Terminator. So this one is coming out.
Terminator, it's been out for a week. It's not a great film, but nor is it absolutely terrible. It's fun to see Arnold Schwarzenegger back. It's certainly better than Terminator 3 and 4, though not near the heights of T1 and T2.
Okay. Terminator Genesis, that is. All right, got to catch up on that, too. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Linda. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to Midday all week long. Have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. midday podcasts, and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.